For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. A gunman wanted in connection with a murder shown on Facebook has been found dead in his car in Pennsylvania. Steve Stevens is believed to have committed suicide after a brief police chase. Our US correspondent Simon Marks reports.
Police in Pennsylvania say they spotted Steve Stevens in the town of Erie, pursued him, but after a brief chase found him dead in his vehicle. He'd been wanted since Sunday when, seemingly at random, he killed a 72-year-old pensioner and broadcast the murder on Facebook. He threatened there would be more killing until he was caught, and the manhunt extended from America's Midwest all the way to New York. Facebook has launched an internal review of its procedures in a bid to keep violent video off its platforms. Simon Marks, Washington.
The UK Prime Minister, Theresa May, has announced she is seeking a snap general election to be held on June 8th. Mrs. May said she wanted a strong mandate as the government enters into complex Brexit negotiations to leave the European Union. From London, FSN's Catherine Drew.
In a surprise announcement, Prime Minister Theresa May took to the podium outside Downing Street to announce that she is requesting Parliament amend current legislation to pave the way for an election on June the 8th. Having long said she would not go to the country before the scheduled election year of 2020, Mrs. May said she had changed her mind, as other political parties were working against her plans for a strong and successful Brexit process. She repeated several times that the UK needed strong and stable leadership at this point, as the country had a one-off chance to get this right. The unexpected announcement has put opposition parties on the spot and comes at a time when Mrs. May's Conservative Party enjoys an overwhelming lead over opposition Labour in the opinion polls. Catherine Drew, London.
Britain's opposition leader, Labour's Jeremy Corbyn, welcomed the surprise announcement.
I welcome the opportunity for us to put the case to the people of Britain to stand up against this government and its failed economic agenda, which has left our NHS in problems, which has left our schools underfunded, which has left so many people uncertain. We want to put a case out there for the people of Britain, of a society that cares for all.
But Theresa May's decision caught many voters unawares.
You're kidding me.
No.
That's interesting. That's interesting because, well, you really caught me in the heart, but you're kidding me. I think she knows that she will win it.
Yeah, I think it's exciting, hopefully an opportunity to stop Brexit.
Look, I'm very surprised, but it was a possibility, wasn't it, that it could happen.
The International Monetary Fund is forecasting improved growth for the global economy in 2017. The IMF is predicting next year we'll see growth up by half a percentage point to 3.5%. In the report, the fund's chief economist, Morris Obstfeld, optimistically wrote that we could be at a turning point. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Good to hear from you. And it's good to be back. My friend, how are you? It is Tuesday, the 18th of April, 2017. It's a beautiful spring evening here in Manchester. My name is Richie Allen. Going to give you the contact details straight away. It's pretty simple to contact me, to tell me what you're thinking. You may tweet me. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. You can email richie@richieallen.co.uk. Broadcasting around the world on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2, Alternate Current Radio, and TuneIn Radio. This is your Richie Allen Show, and it's good to be back.
Broadcasting live from the great city of Manchester, England. This is the Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com. The Richie Allen Show, brought to you in association with davidicke.com. And now, live from Manchester, England, here is Richie Allen.
Now, if you were listening to the news, you would have heard Kevin McAleese make reference to today's announcement by the UK government through the Prime Minister, Theresa May. She wants a snap election on June 8th, which is about 6.5, 7 weeks away, I think. We'll talk about that with Norman Baker, Lib Dem former Home Office Minister. Going to be an interesting conversation, that. Norman has only ever been on this programme one time. That was to talk about David Kelly and his excellent book about the death, the wrongful death of David Kelly. And in the second hour, The former US intelligence officer Scott Rickard returns to the programme Last With Me last July. It's been a while. We'll obviously be talking about Syria, Russia, North Korea, Donald Trump, the foreign policy. Who's controlling Trump's foreign policy? I bet you can guess that in the second hour on Europe's most listened to totally independent news talk show. It's good to be back. Had a lovely week. Lovely week off. Thank you for the kind words today. It was a lovely week as well. Lovely weather. Didn't do an awful lot. Spent a couple of days in Lake, or at, not in Lake Windermere. Although there were people swimming, brave souls. A couple of days up there. Then one or two day trips from the city. We had a lovely relaxing time. It's good to be back though. And thanks for joining me 5 minutes past the hour. So Norman Baker and Scott Rickard are the guests. But of course, going to talk a little bit now, or going to try and talk a little bit now about the big news of the day. You know, the eternal sea, as politics was dubbed many moons ago, has been raging in my absence. A lot's going on, of course, and a lot of it is very confusing, I think, and I'm not going to be making any sense of it for you, and I'm not going to tell you what to think. I have my beliefs, of course, and I might share one or two of them, but I won't tell you what to think or what's going on for sure, because I don't know. Now, our guests will challenge the mainstream version of events for sure. Most of them will anyway, but I don't have all the answers. I have more questions than answers, as usual. Before we crack on, here's PM, the PM, Theresa May, explaining why she called for the early general election June 8th. So I've edited this because you don't want to hear all of it. This is basically the crux of it, according to Theresa May.
Britain is leaving the European Union, and there can be no turning back. And as we look to the future, the government has the right plan for negotiating our new relationship with Europe. We want a deep and special partnership between a strong and successful European Union and a United Kingdom that is free to chart its own way in the world. That means we will regain control of our own money, our own laws, and our own borders. And we will be free to strike trade deals with old friends and new partners all around the world. This is the right approach, and it is in the national interest. But the other political parties oppose it. At this moment of enormous national significance, there should be unity here in Westminster. But instead, there is division. The country is coming together, but Westminster is not. In recent weeks, Labour have threatened to vote against the final agreement we reach with the European Union. The Liberal Democrats have said they want to grind the business of government to a standstill. The Scottish National Party say they will vote against the legislation that formally repeals Britain's membership of the European Union. And unelected members of the House of Lords have vowed to fight us every step of the way.
Right, that was the gist of it there. Basically, I want to rubber stamp my mandate for taking the UK out of the European Union. That's what Theresa May said. That view was endorsed by her Brexit secretary, David Davis.
The country wants us to get on with it. So while you've got the country coming together, you've still got a divided Westminster, with the Labour Party saying they'll vote against the final, or could vote against the final outcome. The SNP saying they are going to vote against the Great Repeal Bill. The Liberal Party saying they're going to fight root and branch, to grind down the process of government. All those things are really going to undermine our negotiating position. So she wants to have a clear mandate, and then we can go to Brussels and do a strong negotiation to deliver a good deal in national interest.
David Davis there. Now, Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell, the Labour leader and shadow chancellor, have welcomed it. Not going to play you any audio. There's not much, really. They haven't said much more. The bookies, though, interestingly enough, have narrowed the odds on Corbyn actually being in place on election day. I don't know what's going on there. At the risk of taking a punt and making a prediction that might be proved wrong or might go wrong, you can't see how Corbyn wouldn't be in place on election day unless the local election results, because local elections are taking place in early May. And if those results were terrible for the Labour Party, there might be some move with only a month to go to the general election. Somebody might move against Corbyn. That's what's being said today. Anyway, the polls, and we don't mean people from Poland, the polls are devastating for Corbyn. That's what it looks like anyway. I don't know how much faith we should put in polls by YouGov and others. But YouGov are saying that at the moment, when people are being asked if there was an election tomorrow, who would you vote for? May is way ahead in the Conservatives on 44%, and Corbyn is languishing with 23%. I've no idea, really. I don't know how they could possibly get rid of Corbyn ahead of a general election. How could they have a leadership contest in that time? I don't know. And I haven't lost my mind. There's no 180 degree turn here. None of this is real. Politics is an illusion. I know this. All will become clear in the next hour or so where we're going with this. Now, Tim Farron, the Lib Dem leader, and we'll be talking with Norman Baker shortly. Tim Farron, very much in the Remain camp, and a very vocal one at that. Farron said this to the BBC today about the election.
Well, I think across the country, people will want to express their view that Britain, whether we are in or out of the European Union, we want to remain in the single market. Theresa May has no mandate to take us out of the single market and for a hard Brexit. It is also the opportunity for the British people to have a decent, strong opposition, something with Labour they now currently do not have.
Are you organised? Are you ready for this fight?
Liberal Democrats have candidates selected right across the country. We were prepared for an election that we thought was going to happen in autumn, and Liberal Democrats are always prepared. Here we are in Cornwall, the place where our fight back really began almost immediately after the general election 2 years ago. From this springboard, we have the opportunity to give the British people the chance to change the direction of our country, to be opposed to a hard Brexit, keep us in the single market, and give Britain the decent, strong opposition that it desperately needs.
He mentioned mandates there, and I want to mention again, and I know this isn't new for you and you might be fed up of it, but it's important to remember that every major politician before June 23rd last year, every single one of them on both sides, whether it was Remain or Leave, every one of them said that leaving the EU meant leaving the single market. Remember this?
The British public would be voting, if we leave, would be to leave the EU and leave the single market.
Should we come out the single market?
I think that is almost certainly would be the case, yes.
Do you want us to stay inside the single market, yes or no?
No, we should be outside the single market.
I had Michael Gove in that chair and I said, after Brexit, will we be in the European single market, yes or no? And he said, no.
And he was right.
So we won't be in the European single
market. Yeah, absolutely.
We'd be out of the single market. That's the reality. Britain would be quitting the single market.
Yeah, Andrea Leadsom. Who else was in there? Gideon Osborne was in there, the pigeon fancier. Cameron was in there. Boris Johnson was in there. It was unequivocal at the time. Leaving meant leaving. That might be interesting when we chat with Norman Baker in a couple of minutes' time. So what's going on then? What's going on? What's happening? Is Theresa May serious? You know, could Labour and the Lib Dems pick up Tory votes, disaffected Tory voters who want to stay in the European Union? Is there any chance that we might see a shock like we've seen in the United States with Trump? Could we have a rainbow coalition? And I suppose many of our UK listeners will never have heard of a rainbow coalition. Coalition governments are all the norm. They're all the rage in the Republic of Ireland, not so much over here. Of course, the last government was a coalition government, but not a rainbow coalition, which means several, more than two parties coming together to form a government. I don't know is the answer. And just to touch on something I said a couple of minutes ago about me not having lost my mind while I was away and me not jumping into politics now and reporting on politics for you. No, I haven't. The people who control both sides of every political debate, both sides of every government, the opposition and the sitting government, those people want the UK inside the European Union. You know this. This is not groundbreaking stuff. Oh, you know it as well. the hidden hand that controls Theresa May, Boris Johnson, the Labour Party, Tony Blair, all these people wants the centralisation of power and needs political unions like the European Union to achieve that goal. So what's going on? Within that reality, within that paradigm, are there men and women who believe they have free will and are doing things that they think are independent? Is May serious? Does May want the UK to leave the European Union, Theresa May? Don't know. I don't know. I'm reminded constantly of the fact I predicted the US election. I got that wrong. I always say to people, well, for the right reasons. I got it wrong for the right reasons, not because I supported anybody. We didn't, and we've said a million times over the last 10 years, Hillary Clinton is the Antichrist. I thought Trump was being used as a stalking horse by the cabal for Hillary. But it turned out something different was going on there. So I don't really know what's going on. What I do know is the establishment will do anything it can to prevent the European Union breaking up. So it will never, or it will try anyway, it will try to prevent the UK leaving, lest other countries follow suit. So something is going on with this, right? But I'm not, it's not that I'm not prepared to make a punt on it. I don't know. I've been asked all day long, could Labour and could the Lib Dems and maybe the Greens, could they do well out of it? Because they're all going to jump on the single market and we must be part of the anti-hard Brexit. And yes, okay, we're leaving the European Union, but we shouldn't have a hard Brexit. Could that give May less of a majority, or could somehow the underdogs secure a victory in June? I just don't know. I really have no idea. Answers on a postcard. Your opinions, of course, to at Richie Allen Show on Twitter or richie@richieallen.co.uk. What I can tell you, and it won't be news to you, is that despite the horrible things happening socially in this country, despite the desecration of the National Health Service, despite the horrendous reality of life as a disabled person or as a senior citizen being screwed to the wall by this Conservative government, these issues will not be covered in the run-up to this election. And this is the kicker, and that's significant somehow in all of this. There won't be hustings debates about social care, about better school places, about not desecrating the police force, about putting money into the NHS, about NHS privatisation. These things won't be discussed. This is pretty much a second European Union referendum. And again, I'm not clever, Clogs, there. You got that yourself today. It's going to be EU, EU, EU. Or, you know, you remember the old saying, the economy, stupid. Well, it's the EU, stupid. That's what's going to be on the table between now and June 8th and nothing else. Just as a side note to that, May must get 2/3 of Parliament tomorrow to agree to the election, which she will, undoubtedly. That's because the Fixed Term Parliament Act came in a few years ago, not so long ago, which made it more difficult to call snap elections. Fixed Term Parliament Act, trying to encourage the seeing out of the 5-year parliamentary term. But all she's got to do is get 2/3 of MPs to say, well, we agree with the election, and then the election will go ahead in June. Of course, it will go ahead. 19 minutes past the hour. You're listening to The Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2, and alternatecurrentradio.com. Bookmark those websites there. Let me just remind you, though, on the Corbyn thing, and it's not to take the opportunity to bash Corbyn. I don't want to do that. They all get bashed, every one of them. But just a couple of things to remember. Before the referendum last year, I gave a lot of criticism, as did many other commentators and producers, to Corbyn for changing his opinion on the European Union. He was a staunch anti-European Union politician for many, many years. In 2009, he said the project has always been to create a huge free market Europe with ever limiting powers for national parliaments and an increasingly powerful common foreign and security policy, said Corbyn. Terrifically explaining and quantifying, categorising even the European Union. He voted against the Maastricht Treaty and he voted against the Lisbon Treaty. He said there is a strong socialist argument against the Lisbon Treaty and the economic consequences that flow from that. Corbyn said it takes away from national parliaments the power to set economic policy and hands it over to an unelected set of bankers who will impose the economic policies of price stability, deflation and high unemployment throughout the European community. But to appease the Blairites in his own party, Corbyn went against every fibre of his being and everything he believed about the European Union, and he urged and campaigned for us to remain in. So he's got no credibility on the European Union. 21 minutes past the hour, Norman Baker, former Home Office Minister, joins me in a couple of minutes. Right now, though, time for a quick break. Back shortly.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Do not invest another pound of your money until you've heard this message. Jim Rickards here, best-selling author of Currency Wars and The Death of Money. But today I'm urging you to claim a free copy of my new best-selling book. Visit newcaseforgold.co.uk for full details. Inside, I reveal why gold could soar to $10,000 an ounce and how to make sure you own enough of the right type of gold. To get your copy dispatched today, go to newcaseforgold.co.uk now. This book will change everything you think you know about investing in gold. Visit newcaseforgold.co.uk today.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Virtually every transaction that involves a child is valuable to somebody.
We intend to show everyone the real reason children are being removed at an alarming rate.
No, this is awful.
The baby's not been seen by the doctor or nothing.
They are psychopathic.
They have got the legal right to kill children now, because that's what they do.
Traffic 2. Available now at premiumonpictures.co.uk.
Welcome back to the programme. It's great to be back. It is Tuesday, April 18th, 2017. A tweet at Richie Allen Show. Share your opinion with other listeners, particularly on what happened today, the election, what's going on, what's the agenda behind it. Educate me, educate one another. What's going on? Well, Norman Baker joins me in a couple of minutes' time. Interesting to get his take on all of this. Before we do that, though, let's have some music. Music Maestro. Europe's most listened to independent radio show. That's a fact. It's not a claim. My name is Richie Allen. Hope you're well. This is Wet, Wet, Wet and Sweet Little Mystery on The Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com.
See, that's
25 minutes past the hour. Wet, sweet little mystery. Welcome back to the programme. Thanks for all the tweets. Hundreds of tweets coming in right now. Let's welcome our next guest back to the programme. He was on the show early last year to talk about his excellent book about the death of the former weapons inspector, Dr. David Kelly. He was a Member of Parliament for Lewis in East Sussex from 1997 until 2015. He was the Home Office Minister in the Coalition Government. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the programme, Norman Baker. Norman, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you, Richie. Fine, well, thank you very much indeed. It's good.
Thanks
good
for doing it. Busy old day today. Theresa May said at the lectern outside Downing Street, effectively, the election is being called because the opposition parties in Westminster have basically corralled together to prevent the democratic democratic will of the British people who voted to leave the European Union. What I'm doing basically is I'm securing, rubber stamping, whatever it is, my mandate. Is that how you see it?
No, of course I don't see it that way. I mean, let's be clear about this. First of all, the British public voted indeed by a narrow margin to leave the European Union, but they didn't vote as to how we should leave the European Union. And there's a big difference between staying in the single market, for example, and this hard Brexit, which she's now being forced into by the extreme right of the Conservative Party. So it's perfectly legitimate to say, let's look at things at the end and see what terms have been negotiated. So the destination is set, and no one's questioning the destination very much, but people are questioning what kind of destination it is, and I think that's legitimate to do that. So let's be clear, she's not calling an election for that reason. She's calling an election because the Tories are 21 points ahead of Labour in the opinion polls, and Labour's on the floor, and she can't resist the opportunity to get a majority. That's why she's calling an election.
I thought you might say that, Norman, especially about the single market. So I'm going to play you a little bit of audio. It's only 20 seconds long.
Okay.
And here are the key players in the referendum last year, Johnson, Gove, Cameron himself, George Osborne, all the Remainers. Have a little listen to this, about 20 seconds long, specifically on the single market.
The British public would be voting, if we leave, would be to leave the EU and leave the single market.
Should we come out the single market?
I think that is almost certainly would be the case, yes.
Do you want us to stay inside the single market, yes or no?
No, we should be outside the single market.
I had Michael Gove in that chair and I said, after Brexit, will we be in the European single market, yes or no? And he said, no.
And he was right.
So we won't be in
the
European
single market. Yeah, absolutely.
We'd be out of the single market. That's the reality. Britain would be quitting the single market.
Now, Norman, I'm not saying this of you, but for me, many of those who wanted the UK to remain in the European Union are being disingenuous at best. But at worst, they're lying when they say that the British people didn't know what they were voting for. They knew full well that Brexit meant Brexit, that meant getting out, severing all economic ties with the European Union. Why are people continuing to say that? Well, they were very clear about it.
Well, no, to be fair, they weren't really. I mean, there was conflicting messages coming from different Leave campaigners. Some were saying we would leave the single market. Others were saying we wouldn't do. Some were saying we're going to spend £350 million a day on the health service or whatever it was, and others didn't say that. I mean, there were mixed messages, and that's why people voted. They voted on a whole range of reasons. Some voted largely because of immigration. That was mainly the issue rather than the single market, I think. But others voted because they didn't like the Prime Minister or they didn't like the Conservative Party or some other reason. And the next day, people were Googling, what is the EU? So, I mean, there are a whole range of reasons why people voted the way they did. But we have got a vote. We've got a vote to leave. I think everybody accepts that. But what we have—that's
not true, Norman. Hang on a second.
Well,
your party leader certainly does not accept it.
No, I mean we've got a vote. No, I think he does. But what he's saying is there should be a vote at the end on the terms, because although people voted to leave, they didn't vote for the hard Brexit, which we're now being faced with. That's a difference, I think.
Yeah, look, we're not going to split hairs for too long on that. You say some people were saying this, some people were saying that. But for me, the main players, and I tried to stress that a second ago, the people who got all the copy, the people who were on our television screens morning, noon and night, were unequivocal in what they were saying, that leaving meant leaving the single market. Now, your leader, and he's not alone, I'm not picking on Tim Farron, but elements within the Labour Party, even former Prime Ministers, you know, they're very arrogant in the way they talk on national television about, you know, we're not so sure that we are going to leave and second referendums and all that nonsense. And to me, Norman, that is an absolute disgrace. That's an insult to the people of the country. You yourself said at the beginning, a narrow, you know, a narrow majority. It doesn't matter if it was 59% to 41 or 52 to 48. The country voted to leave, and we should just get on with leaving, right?
Well, it didn't vote how we leave. That's the point. But on the narrow majority point, you have to bear in mind what Nigel Farage said about 6 weeks before the referendum, and it's in the Daily Mirror. He said, ironically, with the right figures, that a 52-48 vote to remain would not be convincing, and I'd want to keep fighting. That's what he said. So, you know, that's what he said about not winning at 48%. But he appears to think, and others think, that the others who voted to remain and got 48% should now shut up entirely. So there's a bit of double standards going on there.
We talk about opportunism. Is that not what's going on with Tim Farron? I'm not one of these, you know, nasty, sarcastic presenters. I'm not going to be nasty and sarcastic, Norman, and I like you a lot, as you know. But the Lib Dems are on the floor in terms of the showing at the last election. Things have been very bad for the Lib Dems. I know you had a couple of recent, decent by-election results, a couple of gains here and there. But is this not blatant opportunism by Farron trying to tap into maybe disaffected Conservative voters, who Tory voters, maybe even Labour voters who don't trust Corbyn on this particular issue? It's opportunism in the extreme, isn't it?
I don't think... Look, like, first of all, I've retired from politics, really. I mean, I'm kind of doing you a favour because I like your programme.
So yes.
I'm on with you tonight.
Fair enough.
I'm not standing for election, and I'm not particularly frontline politics anymore. So I could just be honest about it. You know, Tim Farron and the Lib Dems have always believed, as I do, that we need to be in the European Union because that's in the interest of the country to be so. So I don't think it's opportunism. I think it's actually strong belief. What he's saying. So as far as electoral prospects are concerned, yes, we had an absolutely terrible election in 2015. And, you know, people like me lost our seats. We went down from 58, I think it was, to 9. I mean, it was a terrible, terrible result. But what's happened since then hasn't been a bounce back to 58, but we have been winning by-elections in very unlikely seats from UKIP, from the Tories, from Labour, from the Greens. We're doing very well. We won the Richmond by-election, which is the last big contest in a Lib Dem winnable seat. And I'll make a prediction for you on air. The two parties that will do best in the general election in June are the Tories and Lib Dems. Ironically, the two coalition parties. They're the ones who are going to go up. Labour and UKIP are going to go down. That's my prediction. You can hold me to it.
Yeah, listen, and I just want to reiterate, I wasn't having a dig at you talking about the showing in 2015. No, mate, no. You know I have a lot of time for you. We disagree vehemently on Europe, but I have a lot of time for you, Norman, and thanks for coming back on the programme. Listen, hasn't this whole idea that it's vital that we're in the single market, hasn't that been thoroughly debunked now? I mean, I've had a number of different economists on the programme, and I can be honest with you, Norman, they were economists from different political points of view, and basically, ultimately, we export more to Europe. There are more EU citizens here than there. The European Union is never going to cut off its nose to spite its face. We have nothing to worry about in terms of trade deals in the within the single market. We're going to be bloody well fine on our own.
Well, time will tell. I mean, the point is, 27 countries have lost one country. One country has lost 27. So that's how I see the equation. And what the government's doing now is scrabbling around the world, trying to do deals with all sorts of really quite unpleasant people, like the guy who runs the Philippines, and so on. And we were scrabbling around for dictators and nasty people to make up the difference. And actually, the people who are on our doorstep are our natural market. So time will tell. I don't think either of us really know at the moment, but it seems to me to be foolish to throw away the market on our doorstep.
On the doing dodgy deals with dodgy people, I agree with that. It's dreadful to see the Prime Minister of this country or anybody else in government, you know, meeting the Saudis and other whiffy people. But some of our listeners now will be shouting at the radio. They will say, Richie, Norman was in coalition with the Conservatives. Did Norman raise these concerns when the Tories were selling arms to the Saudis during the period you were in government together? Did you?
Yeah, the answer is we did. We did. And the Lib Dems made a difference because we did get some more controls on arms sales, actually, when we were in the coalition than we had before. We also got steps to close tax loopholes and deal with some of these overseas territories we had. So we did make progress on that. But, you know, I would just say to your listeners this. Look at what the coalition government was like for 5 years, and look at what this particularly hard right government is like now. And that's the difference that Lib Dems made.
You and I will never agree on the European Union. So while I have you, and thanks for staying with us, there's a couple of other issues I'd love to get your thoughts on. Listen, you know Reg Keyes very well. Reg has been on this programme umpteen times. We love Reg. Reg's son, Lance Corporal Tom Keyes, was killed very early on in Iraq. The families are hanging on, Norman, to the idea that they might be able to take, I'm going to call him an unashamed, unapologetic war criminal, Tony Blair, to task, maybe in some sort of civil court. This was in the papers again today. What hope, if any, can you offer those who want to see this guy accounted for or held to account in some court somewhere for the millions, let's be honest about it, the millions of lives that his policies destroyed?
Well, not just millions of lives. I mean, millions of lives are millions of lives, and that's a huge thing to have on your conscience. But it's also the fact that the Middle East is now a hotbed for terrorism and completely dysfunctional, and that largely falls out of the way the Americans and British dealt with Iraq in 2003. So there's a long-term legacy from that. And the idea that Tony Blair can be a peace envoy is beyond satire. You know, satirists should go home and pack up their jobs when that sort of thing happens. So is he going to be brought to court? I'd like to think he was, because we got an international criminal court. People who behave in disreputable, unacceptable ways should be hauled before that court. It's not simply a court for Africans, you know, although it seems to be. It should also be a court for Europeans and Americans who behave in ways which are unacceptable as well. Will he be taken before the court? I doubt it very much. But, you know, just look at Tony Blair. Look at the way his features are now so haggard. And although he's not been brought before a court, he is paying a very heavy personal price for the decisions he took. He's finished in terms of his reputation now, 15 years on.
He doesn't look well, to be honest.
He doesn't look well. He's living, you know, like the portrait of Dorian Gray. You know, there's probably a picture of him in the attic, not aging, the other way around from Dorian Gray. He's aging very badly, and his decisions are showing on his face.
Norman, I have this theory about Blair and why the likes of Blair won't be held to account. And it's a pretty basic theory. It's because we continue to commit these egregious crimes on the international stage even today. We backed Donald Trump's bombing of Syria based on the contention that the Assad government bombed and gassed innocent civilians there with no evidence presented, Norman. Now, I'm not saying he did or he didn't, but with no evidence whatsoever presented. And to me, that old Irish thing of it being deja vu all over again.
Well, I know what you mean. I mean, my guess is, and I don't know either way, to be honest with you, I'm not party to the information. My guess is he probably did gas them. But the reality of life in the Middle East is this. We have to deal with the situation as it is. And part of foreign policy is, unfortunately, dealing with unpleasant people, because sometimes the other lot are even more unpleasant than the ones you've got. And, you know, I've got no time for Assad, who is clearly an utter bit of work. But the fact of the matter is, if Assad went tomorrow, we would have ISIS coming in. We'd have complete chaos in that country. This is what happened after Saddam Hussein went. I don't hold a candle for Saddam Hussein. He was a horrible man. And vile to his people and behaved in ways which you and I would regard as well beyond the pale. But the reality of removing Saddam Hussein was complete chaos in Iraq. So we have to be very careful that in dealing with a problem that we see and something we don't like, we don't actually create a worse problem.
And of course, with Hussein, anything that he did to his own people, he did it with the blessing of the West, because he used the weapons that were sold to him by envoys like Donald Rumsfeld. I'll tell you where I am with Syria, Norman. I'm tired of this sort of nonsense. I haven't seen any evidence, any genuine evidence, that Assad brutally put down any genuine uprising in his country. I'm tired of the dreadful media in this country and in other Western countries going along with the military-industrial complex line. Here's a bad dictator. He's doing bad things, therefore we must get rid of him, and giving us no evidence whatsoever. In fact, Syria looked like a pretty good place pre-2009, 2010. The United Nations even said, Jesus, this guy is really good. He's a reformer. He's meeting all his millennial goals. And bang, a couple of years later, we've even had the French former foreign minister Roland Dumas come out and say that he knew in 2009, 2010 that the intelligence agencies of this country and others were planning things in Syria. It's absolutely dreadful. You know?
I mean, look, I mean, leave aside, even if Saddam, even if Assad is a vile person, and even if it's all true, Richie, what's been said, and I don't know if it's true or not, even if it is true, let's say it is for a moment, what happens if he's removed? That's a question which people need to ask themselves. And the answer is a far worse situation, frankly, than we have at the moment, because it would be complete chaos. We've seen chaos in the Middle East everywhere. And we can't just go around getting rid of people we don't like. You know, by what right do we do that, by the way? What is our reason for doing that? Who says that Britain has the right to go and remove people from countries which are running them? You know, that's not...
Absolutely.
That's not ethical. And also, if we're going to start removing people who are unethical, you know, what about Xi Jinping in China? What about the guy in the Philippines? What about a whole range of people across the world?
The House of Saud.
Who are pretty unethical. We don't remove them, do we? So we cannot have a situation where geography is a branch of morality.
Norma, stay with me for three more minutes, because I've got a couple of really good questions coming in on Twitter. Huge interest in this. By the way, folks, I can't recommend enough that you read The Strange Death of Dr. David Kelly. The Strange Death of David Kelly by Norman. It's available at all good online book retailers. A fantastic book about David Kelly. Great work Norman did on that and other things. Hugely important story. That's, you know, in light of what we're talking about now, of course, as well, Dr. David Kelly there. Norman, a lot of our listeners are tweeting. They're pretty polite, but they're annoyed. They're saying, look, what unfettered immigration did, and look, we know there are people who talk about immigration, and we know that their ultimate motivations are maybe they're not good, maybe they are xenophobic, maybe they are, I don't know. But a lot of people don't like being labelled like that. They said what the European Union open border policy did was, and it's irrefutable, they're telling me on Twitter, it drove living standards down in this country, it drove wages down, and we have a higher rate of child poverty in this country today than we have had for years. So people are getting fed up of being called xenophobic, not by you, Norman, but by others. And they're saying, look, the overwhelming amount of numbers coming in here, our public services weren't able to take that. It was always known. And that on its own is a good enough reason to take control of our own immigration policy. Go ahead.
Well, you know, one thing I've learned in politics over many years is very few things are completely black and white. And is the European Union wonderful in all regards? No, it isn't. Is it worth throwing the baby out with the bathwater? No, it isn't. Was the immigration policy in the European Union right? No, I don't think it was. Was there a problem that arose as a consequence of the open borders? Yes, there was, and it needs to be amended. But the idea that the answer to that is to leave the European Union, in my view, is not the right answer. And in terms of immigration, yes, there have been undue pressures in some areas, and I absolutely understand it in some towns where there's been a significant immigrant arrival. It's changed the character of that town in a way people feel uncomfortable with. I understand that. And I remember canvassing in Southall many years ago for a by-election with the Indian population down there, who were now about 90% of the population. And there were, you know, a few ethnic British, if you like, who were there who were completely disorientated. So I do understand that that point people make. But I also understand that our health service and agriculture and other parts of our essential society would not function properly without people coming into the country to do those jobs. And I also understand that the people who are coming in, by and large, are younger, and they're the ones who are paying the pensions, because there aren't enough young British people to pay the pensions and triple lock, which the government generously has given. So, I mean, you know, I'm not saying it was all right, it wasn't all right, but I do think it's not black and white, and we have to... The answer would have been, in my view, to have a more sensible control of immigration and stay in the European Union. That wasn't, I'm afraid, an offer. We were presented with either one extreme or the other, neither of which is to my liking, frankly.
Fair enough. I'm going to ask you one final... This is the absolute final question. Thanks for coming back on the programme, Norman. I really appreciate it. Look, I'm a history graduate. It's my belief that... We don't talk about this often enough, but the madman Hitler and the Nazi lunatics, a lot of industrialists that we know about supported them in the hope that in the event that they would secure a victory in Europe, that they would get the spoils of Europe economically after that. I think that what we've seen with the European Union is a centralisation of power that's worked for massive companies and for banks, Norman, and not for people, and not for people's jobs and prosperity. It's driven money uphill to banks, particularly banks, and to major corporations.
Yeah.
And you know, we see now, you know, the call for a European army, ever-increasing political union. And it's for those reasons, that centralisation of power that lost the sovereignty, to make it easier for globalists to do what they want, that I would always be against it. You've the final word, my friend, and then we'll move on. Go ahead.
Very kind of you. Well, look, I would say that, yes, there are powers of multinational companies, and globalisation does affect individuals. But, you know, the way to deal with that is for countries to come together to regulate internationally in the way the UN should be doing. And for Britain to leave the European Union actually hands more power to the multinational companies than it would do if we stayed in the European Union. So that's actually a bit of an own goal on our basis. But last point, Richie, I'd make is this. When things get tough, people start moving towards the strong man. They did it with Hitler in the 1930s and Mussolini. They're doing it perhaps now with Marine Le Pen in France, and with this guy Erdogan in Turkey. And no good will come of it. History shows that giving power, too much power to one individual, never works very well in the long run. And that's a lesson I hope that everybody will agree with.
Norman, great to hear from you. Thanks for coming back on the programme. Look after yourself.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Bye for now. You too. Former Home Office Minister Norman Baker there, and former Lib Dem MP for many years, on the line to us there from his home. It's 14 minutes to the top of the hour. I'll read the tweets. Mark says, Richie, great point. The Libs would have an open door policy. Norman kicks it into the long grass without answering for or against, says Mark. I think he did answer it, Mark. He went around about way of answering it, but he did answer it there. Keep those tweets coming in. Hi to Gail, hi to Sean McDonald, hi to Faisal. Let me scroll down, loads of comments coming in there. Hi to David Mortimer. David, how are you? Thanks for your tweets as well. Hi to Sue, to Heraclitus, who says, the oil pipe running through Syria, that is more important for the cabal than if Assad is ousted and the country destroyed. That's from Heraclitus. I think I said that right second time round. Hi to Fluffles. Hi to David McKenna. David says, Richie, this Norman guy is a clown. He's not a clown, David. He's a man with an opinion, and his opinions have always been consistent, regardless of whether we agree with them or not. Okay, I understand you disagree with him. I know Richie doesn't like this outlook, said David, but these politicians don't really believe what they are saying. That was David McKenna there. Hi to GP Brown. How you doing, GP, who tweets, they cannot stop the conflict in Syria as ISIS provide the excuse for regime change. It's ultimately true as well. Hi to Mazroth. Hi to Base Ninja. Norman's guess is wrong, says Base Ninja. It makes zero sense for the Syrian government to do this crime. Bomb a depot and use as propaganda, possibly. Well, that's right. And the point I made is no evidence. And there is no evidence that Assad began to brutally suppress a revolution in his country either. None fabricated by the Western media and the military-industrial complex, with no dissenting voice whatsoever outside of the independent media, that is. Of course, 100%. I made the point about how Syria was a beacon of light onto the rest of the region, according to the powers that be, until it suited him to say that he was a madman putting down the revolution that really wasn't a revolution at all. The so-called colour revolution, supported by agents of the United States through backers like George Soros and others. We know exactly what's gone on there. Hi to Andy. Seems like Norman is on message re-Assad. Typical politician, says Andy. Well, Andy, he did admit, after I pressed him, that he doesn't know what's happened and what hasn't happened, which is another way of admitting that his opinion was formed by watching Sky News, by reading The Telegraph, by watching BBC News 24. There's no doubt about that. It is exactly 9 minutes to the top of the hour. This is your Richie Allen Show, in association with DavidIke.com. We're broadcasting on Alternate Current Radio and Fab Radio 2. Good to be with you. This is Roy Orbison.
Every time I look into your loving eyes, I see love that money just can't buy.
It's good to be back, I tell you. It's good to be back. Roy Orbison, you got it on your Richie Allen Show, 8 minutes to the top of the hour. Great to be with you. It really is. Glorious evening in Madchester. Still bright out, looking out the window of the studio there. All I can see is foliage, leaves, trees. Really nice. Spring. Spring has sprung. It's good stuff. Scott Ricker joins us in the second hour. We'll talk about Kim Jong-un. We'll talk about Korea. How much of this is annual? How much of this do people forget? That every single year, the United States and South Korea conduct joint military exercises that pisses off the North. And every year, the North says stuff about reacting with weapons. And every year, the Telegraph, the Mail and the Express say we're on the verge of World War III. Or is it different this time? You see, I think it might be different this time, and we don't do fear-mongering on this programme. We don't believe in it, but I think it's different. Scott Rickard, former intelligence officer, joins the programme in the second hour. 7 minutes to the top of the hour. It's Tuesday, April 18th, 2017. You are listening to The Richie Allen Show. Check out our broadcast partners, alternatecurrentradio.com, fabradio2, and davidicke.com. David is in Gothenburg in Sweden. A very good friend of mine lives there, but he won't be able to pay David a visit this weekend, sadly. A great old pal of mine from Waterford, Ray Power, lives in Gothenburg. I've never visited, but I believe it's one of the most beautiful cities you could possibly wish to see. And I got an email from Mikey earlier on, and I think he confirmed, yes, it is lovely there. Incredible time for him to be in Sweden with all that's going on there with the immigration issues there and everything else. So that's part of the Worldwide Wake Up Tour this Saturday. The tour, of course, continues through 2017. To find out where David is going to be, simply go to theworldwidewakeup.com. Faisal tweets, Richie, foliage is what you wrap your sandwiches in. Yes, it is. I was being ironic. It's one of those words when I was younger I struggled to pronounce. Foliage. Foliage. Foliage, indeed. Foliage it is. Hi, William Henderson, by the way. Good to have you back, and more Roy Orbison, please. I don't know about that. Hi to Paul Jackson. Put my speakers up a tad there, said Paul. Roy Orbison gone down well. And Natalie Stacey. Anyone else seen that a certain... Or I'm not going to read that. Because I said I would leave it. I'm not going to talk anymore about a tattooed man who ran a pyramid scheme last year. I'm not going to say any more about him. I'm done with all of that. Went to therapy in my week off. No more. No more of that. There might be more of it, depending if he surfaces again. Hi to Karen Kelly in Glasgow. How are you doing, Karen? They won't stop until Assad is gone. That's what they want, says Karen there. And Alex Doust. Good evening, Alex. Good evening, Millie. Alex tweets, good on you for bringing people on with different opinions. How boring it would be to just tune into agreeing every day. Well, Alex, you've been listening to the programme long enough. And while you're absolutely right, to say it is boring to hear people agreeing with one another all the time, the motivation for bringing people like Norman on, Norman is a former frontline politician. It's to put our theories of the way things are to people like Norman in the hope that people who don't normally listen to programmes like this might listen and might have a second look at the work of the many guests who come on this programme to expose the conspiracy. That's why we continue to do it. Simple as that. I want to say hi to Jen Crosby, by the way. Jen, how are you? And thanks for the lovely tweet earlier on. I understand your mum's not been well recently, Jen. I hope that she will be well and that she's on the mend there, Jen. That's Jen in California, who sent me a picture of some foliage in California. You know, when I used to do these programmes years ago, the idea that people could listen and send you pictures instantaneously. I know, it's a boring thing to say, but it still sometimes grabs me. You know, it still shakes me up a bit. I remember struggling years ago with taking phone calls. I was thinking that was a remarkable thing. Wonderful thing. People send you pictures now and participate. Wonderful stuff. 3 minutes to the top of the air. Scott Rickard on the programme. Looking forward to tomorrow's programme because I'm going to be joined by none other than Khalid Khan. Now, I like Khalid. We've been following one another on Twitter for a while. And Khalid is the vice chairman of UKIP in Barnet. And he's a very interesting man, Khalid. He's got a lot of very interesting things to say about Syria and also about the European Union and more besides. So I've invited Khalid on the programme. He joins me tomorrow as well. And I'll update you, of course, on social media throughout the week as to who's going to be on the programme on subsequent days. The best thing to do, if you haven't done it already, is to follow us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/TheRichieAllenShow. Couldn't be simpler. If you haven't subscribed to us on Facebook already, do it now. Do it now and swell my ego by giving me more Facebook followers. I say in jest, I couldn't give an arse. But anyway, if you are connected on Facebook, I put a couple of things on there during the day, guests and stuff like that, so there you go. Going to take a very quick break. When we come back, one or two more things to tell you. Scott Rickard is standing by in Florida, and we're going to be talking about the US, foreign policy, neocons, Trump, where all this is going. Scott's a really interesting guy.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at Now.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbayerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Virtually every transaction that involves a child is valuable to somebody.
We intend to show everyone the real reason children are being removed at an alarming rate.
No, this is awful.
The baby's not been seen by the doctor or nothing.
They are psychopathic.
They have got the legal right to kill children now, because that's what they're doing.
Traffic 2, available now at premilonpictures.co.uk.
Broadcasting the information the mainstream media won't touch. This is The Richie Allen Show, in association with DavidIke.com.
Welcome back, and thanks for all the tweets. It's nice to be appreciated every now and then. It's nice to know so many of you missed the programme in the short time we were off air. I'm just going to give it to you straight. Apart from a couple of bank holidays coming up, the programme will carry on until sometime in mid-August. That's the way it always works. I take a week off in April, a couple of weeks in August, and the Christmas break, and only the bank holidays in between, or if something comes up that can't be avoided, very rarely. Nearly 250 live radio programmes, Sunday views, and TV programmes were broadcast by yours truly last year in 2016. That's not bad, eh? That's not bad. Nearly 250. It'll be about the same as this year. So a couple of bank holidays coming up, and I'll be with you right through till the middle of August when I will take my summer holiday. Alrighty. Because you're nosy parkers, you know what I mean? So what's the story about holidays in 2017, Richie? None of your bloody business. Alright, it is your business. So two bank holidays coming up over the next few weeks, I think. And then it'll be you and I all the way through till August. Lots going on. A couple of cryptic emails and one critical email, which I accept. I don't mind the criticism. Criticism is good, it's fair, and when it's warranted. I had an email from Jill who said, Richie, you're sounding very mainstream there. You're sounding very political. You're sounding very Radio 5 Live. Couldn't you couldn't have insulted me any worse than that. No, I'm not. Look, these things are happening. And we must comment on these things. We must try to get to the bottom of what's going on without losing sight of what it is that we, at the core of the show, believe. That is, the cabal is a plan to centralise power through unions. NAFTA, all these unions, AFRICOM. We know this, right? We know this. And that same cabal controls both sides of the political spectrum. So what's going on? We have to determine what's going on. There are several possibilities. I don't know which one it is. Are the Lib Dems, Labour and the Greens going to gain enough ground to put serious pressure on Theresa May in June? I don't know. I doubt it, but I don't know. Love to know. You know, the pro-European Union people. I don't know. Is the election being used by the cabal to wipe Corbyn out completely? To then place a Rothschild Zionist at the helm of the Labour Party so that maybe there can be a change of government in 2022 and another referendum before then or around about that time with the European Union? I don't know. But it smells. That's all I do know. But we have to talk about these things. It's very relevant to what's going on. You can't explain to Mr. and Mrs. Joe Soap, who don't understand, never heard of David Icke, or they did hear of David and think he's mad, or Jim Mars, or the great men and women who come on this programme. Got to engage with them on their level. And their level is politics, is BBC 24, is Sky News. Right, 4 minutes past the hour, just approaching 4 minutes past the hour. Got some more music for you. When we come back, Scott Rickard joins the programme. Scott's in Florida. He's got a lot to say about what's happening in US domestic politics and with particular emphasis on foreign policy. We'll talk South Korea, North Korea, of course, Russia and Syria. You don't want to miss Scott. He's a really interesting guy. Really interesting guy. This is Dolly Parton then. Who picks the music on this program? Back with Scott after this.
Jolene, 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 Jolene. Voice is soft like summer rain, and I cannot compete with you, Jolene. He talks about you in his sleep, and there's nothing I can do to keep from crying when he calls your name, Jolene. And I can easily understand how you could easily take my man, but you don't know what he means to me, Jolene.
Dolly Parton, Jolene on the Richie Allen Show. Let's crack on with it then. It's 6 minutes past the hour. Do follow my next guest, by the way, on Twitter. Follow him on Twitter. It's @Scott_Rickard. Follow him there. Top man. Last on the programme last summer, so it's been a while since he was on. Over 3 decades working with national security and international service providers and as an intelligence linguist in the American intelligence circles. And he regularly comments on issues of national security and geopolitics for Press TV, RT and many others. Terrific to welcome back to the programme our old friend Scott Rickard. Scott, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you for having me back, Richie. First off, I want to apologize for the last time you had me on. I had made a desperate remark about the demise of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump only to offend you, and I apologize for that. I'm certainly not for capital punishment as well, and I also offended some of your readers.
Not at all. So. Hey, Scott, the whole point of this program is we engage with people whom we like, number one, but number two, who might occasionally disagree with us. It's terrific. You certainly never offended me, but thanks for saying that. Not at all. No, the banging heads and different opinions is vitally important, and I think you'll acknowledge in the independent media, which is vital in this era of, you know, terrible mainstream media, it's vital that we disagree on things and we argue from time to time to keep our listeners awake, number one, but to show them that, you know, there are differences between us. Listeners, brilliant to have you back on the program. When I announced you were coming on today...
It's interesting you say that because I just did an interview on Press TV this week, and the gentleman running the studio... after the interview, he said, you know, the most patriotic thing you can do is speak out against the atrocities of your governments, because the other side of the debate was a research fellow from Massachusetts Institute of Technology who was basically, he wasn't supporting an attack on North Korea, but he certainly wasn't giving any empathy to the North Koreans based upon the horrific history that they've had to endure from the West.
Absolutely right. Now, Scott, let's start with North Korea. You've been watching this for many years, and you'll know that at this time of year, every year, the US and South Korea, they have these joint military exercises. It cheeses off the North Koreans. They make some very, very strong statements. And we have this go-round. Now, I mentioned earlier on, and I'm certainly no expert, it feels a bit different this time. It doesn't feel as contrived or as staged as it has done in the past. It's worrying a lot of people, Scott. How are you reading this North Korean situation?
Well, interestingly enough, when I began my career in the intelligence community, I was a Korean linguist collecting intelligence for the Air Force around North Korea, along the DMZ, and up in the Sea of Japan and elsewhere. And interestingly enough, the history that I had at the time, I knew very little about it. And Jimmy Carter was actually just going to pull the troops out of South Korea because we had crashed yet another helicopter in the DMZ, and they had held 8 American soldiers captive. You know, obviously that wasn't a truthful statement from Jimmy Carter. Certainly we're looking at 30 some odd years later, and we have just as many troops there. There's you know, several hundred thousand troops, and we, as you said, we one of our, it is actually our largest military exercise on the globe, other than the active military engagements that is going on you know, an annual event. And, you know, given any empathy to the North Koreans based upon the horrific war that was engaged upon them post-World War I, the Korean War, and the tremendous, I guess, deceit, even in the latest treaty put together by Clinton, whereby a lot of the complexities of building a nuclear power facility that would actually have less capability of creating a nuclear weaponry, the Americans failed to commit on their side of the treaty. And it goes on and on when you look at the tremendous amounts of sanctions and just tremendous amounts of isolation that's been imposed by the West. So as a North Korean, you know, I too would be very susceptible. And I'm not pro, you know, pro nuclear weaponry. But if I were a North Korean leader, I would think that having a nuclear weapon would actually protect me from what the Americans have been up to when you look at what they've done to Iraq and Syria and Yemen and Libya and so on and so forth. So as a leader of a sovereign nation, very much like Iran and certainly Pakistan succeeded, this gives a country, unfortunately, the safeguards that they require in order to prevent an invasion and create a formidable deterrent to the tremendous amounts of invasive and destructive nature of American foreign policy that's unfortunately been going on, I would say, since the early 1900s.
This is really important because, and we will talk about Trump and his cabinet, shortly. But on North Korea, we often talk, people like you and I, about how we categorise countries that we want to invade and destroy. So we make up stories, we invent stories about dictators and crimes. We've seen it so many times over the years. We're seeing it again in Syria. But North Korea is a strange one, because most people in the independent media, myself included, would look upon the North Korean authorities and see them as incredibly austere, brutally punishing of their people. And I wonder how much of that is true and how much of that is basically Western propaganda. Because we see every now and then the BBC will do a story, Amnesty will fly some planes over the country or near the country, and even today on the BBC we had journalists talking about death camps. What's the absolute naked truth, Scott, as we understand it, about life in North Korea?
Well, you have to take into consideration the historical value of the Asian societies. When you look at Japan, what was originally the Korean peninsula prior to the split, you know, if you look at the Yi dynasties and you go back into history, you know, these are very, I would say, obedient and a very honorable societies. You know, the whole time I lived in Okinawa, there was never a crime committed by an Okinawan. All the crimes were being committed by American soldiers. At the same time, in North Korea, it is extremely crime-free. You know, you have an incredibly low crime rate. You know, it's a very, obviously controlled society. But Japan was like that as well under the emperors. And so this is, a cultural difference, you know, that obviously in the West and certainly, you know, from our European and British historical societies that have been more dominant on the planet in the Western societies, you know, it doesn't feel the same. But for an Asian society and for individuals, you know, if you look at the way that Korea was formed and the language was actually created as sort of a cryptic or a language that was it was actually the most recent language in modern history, and it was actually created by scholars in order for them to separate themselves from the Mongols so that they could actually root out any types of infiltrators or spies, you know, using linguistics. So it's just the nature of being extremely cautious, which I do not blame the North Koreans for being extremely cautious. You know, it killed off well over 20% of their society. You know, and had it not been for the Chinese, obviously, there would be no North Korea. And then at the same time, you know, South Korea obviously received the same reparations and the same, financial benefits of dealing with the West as Japan did. So it's just a different evolution. You know, I often say this about Iran and other countries that are, what they say about, you know, Syria and, it doesn't take too long ago in the United States history where, you know, less than 100 years ago, women couldn't vote. African-Americans couldn't vote at the time. You just don't have a whole lot of history here of this quote unquote free society, where I believe it's more of a facade, you know, based upon you're only free, you know, obviously, if you're cooperating with the rules and regulations of that society. And as I said earlier in the show, if you speak out against any of the actions of your government, obviously you're not killed in the United States, but you certainly are ostracized as, you know, as conspiracy theorists. I've been called on CNN or, you know, obviously they're not going to invite me anytime soon to Fox or CNN or NBC.
Absolutely. Scott Rickard is on the line, folks. A terrifically experienced intelligence expert and linguist. So, Scott, before we talk about what's happened with Trump, because since we last spoke, he's taken office, obviously. I think we spoke shortly before or shortly after he won the election. He's in office now. We'll talk about that and what's happened since. But with respect to the tension now, with not just with North Korea, but with Russia, Syria and everything else, in your experience, and you've been looking at these, you've been looking at this for many years, and at times we have tense moments and things happen and things are said. Does this feel a bit more like the real deal to you?
Well, it's not necessarily the real deal. You have a very egotistical, bombastic, and very irresponsible individual who doesn't act objectively or reasonably in any sense of the word. And this is, you know, obviously part of his naivety, easily swayed based upon, you know, simple statements as, well, Obama wouldn't do it. So, you know, that would be enough to sway his opinion, or his daughter may come across the hall crying and he might make a decision. So this is a very unpredictable enigma when it comes to, you know, they basically handed powers over to an angry child that can make a very rash decision. So I would say from a danger perspective, absolutely, this individual could allow bad advice to filter through the sieve quite easily. And certainly he's surrounded himself with some individuals who are extremely capable of giving him bad advice. So is it anything different? I say it's similar to Bush Cheney. George Bush, H.W.'s son, was nowhere near as smart as H.W. And certainly Dick Cheney had surrounded George W. With just a tremendously similar group of individuals that are surrounding Donald Trump. That being said, I would say that Donald Trump has surrounded himself with a more Likudnik, extreme pro-Israel sort of cabinet, and certainly with his son-in-law, his advisor. This advisorship, you will see a tremendous amounts of support for really hard right Israeli policy that I don't think that you've seen before when it comes to the Middle East. But certainly when it comes to North Korea, I don't believe that Donald Trump understands the capacity at which the Chinese could respond. They've already got 150,000 troops on the north border of North Korea. So there certainly isn't any chance that the Chinese will allow the West to do anything in North Korea quietly. They've always been pretty much the arbitrator, even since the Korean War.
Scott, do you think it's possible? Only that it's possible. I think you might disagree with it, but you might also say it's possible. I've known a bit about Donald Trump over the years. I watched the bloody Apprentice. God forgive me. When it first came out, because it was played over here by BBC, I think the BBC showed it when
I'm
it first
sorry.
Came out. Yeah, but you know what? It was entertainment and it was funny. You know, it was funny to see these so-called businessmen.
We are definitely amused to death. I agree.
Yeah, it made us laugh, and I knew a bit about him before that, but I suppose only what I read in magazines. And for my sins many years ago, I speed read The Art of the Deal. I know it's dreadful. Listen, do you think, because look, whatever this guy is, he's not stupid. He's
a tchotchke salesman,
right? So eventually to my question, right, isn't it possible this guy, he obviously tweeted out that Obama was wrong to intervene in Libya. You know, he was very much anti-intervention as a private citizen, or at least as a public celebrity. That's the way he was. But because of the childlike, narcissistic tendencies of him, because of his appeal, because of his celebrity status, could he have been chosen specifically by that neocon Zionist hidden hand because he could be manipulated so easily? Has that happened on our watch and we didn't see it coming?
No, I certainly saw it coming early on.
You saw it coming, right?
I saw it with Hillary Clinton. I saw it with Barack Obama. It certainly happened with George Bush. It did not happen with H.W. I actually went to H.W.'s inauguration and was shocked that they were allowing the CIA to run the president's office. But that was, you know, the last intelligence guy that we had in the White House. Prior to that, I'd have to go back to maybe Nixon had a little bit of intelligence. Certainly JFK had a bit. Lyndon Johnson was nothing more than a Zionist puppet. For God's sakes, his neighbor was the owner of Orion Pictures, another propaganda outlet out of Hollywood. So, yeah. You know, unfortunately, Americans learn their history from Hollywood, and certainly we know that the mainstream media is unfortunately, and I don't think that they're doing it, as calculated as people believe. People actually, these commentators actually believe what they're saying, unfortunately, and I think it's just due to their lack of personal research. Or potentially their lack of their inability to break outside of their own indoctrinations.
It's really important you said that about those commentators believing what it is they say. If they didn't, they wouldn't be able to sell it as well. I think you're absolutely right on that. Before we talk about Syria, what happened with the bombing, the allegations made about Assad gassing civilians and the lack of evidence of all of that, and Trump, of course, has been embraced by some of the mainstream media who previously allegedly opposed him because they're happy that he's dropping bombs on Syria. But before we go down that road, you and I talk a lot. I mean, I do this program all the time. You write and you blog and you're excellent. And I've told people to follow you on Twitter, at Scott_Rickard on Twitter. We talk a lot about the Zionists, the Rothschild Zionist cabal, the banking cabal. Over the last 3-4 presidential administrations, have we seen the total takeover of your country by neocon Zionists? If you look at the makeup of cabinets over the last 20 years, the Trump cabinet, it's checkmate now by the Zionist cabal, isn't it? It basically owns your elected officials, your government, effectively.
Well, it's been going on since the early 1900s. Wilson was being advised by Edward Bernays, who was basically working for the propagandist Samuel Untermyer in the early 1900s, and was very instrumental in getting the Americans involved in even World War One. So, I mean, and certainly Truman had his focus group. Jesus, even Winston Churchill had a focus group that pushed him to the top and made him some sort of hero to the unfortunately to the British people. You know, the wool has been pulled over your eyes as well in Great Britain. So you know, obviously this is not a new game. Obviously the game has become more complex and more difficult for people to understand. You know, if you use the word Zionist now, you're immediately labeled an anti-Semite. You know, it has nothing to do with Judaism. It absolutely has to do with a political organization, much like communism, capitalism, you know, any type of Zionism is just a political movement that was started in the late 1800s and was very successful at aligning itself with governments and banking institutions, and has been successful now for well over 120, 30 years.
What did you make of what happened in Syria? 8 or 9 or 10 days ago, did you see? I was away. In fact, I was just finishing my week and going away for a week's holidays when it happened. And I talked about it on the Friday. It happened on the Thursday night, Friday morning, of course. And then I was away. And I've been watching, even while on holiday, the reaction to it. What people are saying, of course, that because of the probably false, well, not probably, definitely false allegations that Trump was in cahoots with the Russians and that the Russians swung the election for him, which I think is absolute nonsense. People are saying that Trump needed a war very quickly to deflect away from what was being said and the congressional hearings and inquiries into whether or not key Trump allies or key Trump employees were doing deals with Russia. So people were saying, well, he needed something, and he needed the excuse and the false flag, the claims of a chemical attack, which might not even have happened, against the Assad government. Trump would have to do something, and that would push to the back burner, the idea that Trump was basically a Russian puppet. How do you see all of what's happened in the last 10 days with respect to that, Scott?
Well, I don't think it had as much to do with Trump trying to deflect his relationship with his Russian contacts. Obviously, everyone knows that he had contacts. Everyone knows, Jesus, most of the congressmen and the senators and so on and so forth, have had contact in one way or another with Russian finance and diplomatic individuals. So that means nothing to me. What was more interesting to me was how orchestrated the media onslaught was, and how well, I guess, supported. First the onslaught came out in the absolute nature. You know, you only had a few Congress persons talking against the fact that, hey, we don't have any evidence to support this yet. And all the American intelligence community was providing, saying there were planes in the area. Well, you know, there were planes in the area bombing a building. That doesn't mean anything. You know, we can track planes, and certainly at any time. You have to get the actual facts on the ground. You know, what kind of chemical was deployed? How was it deployed? What was the nature of the explosion? And getting an idea of, you know, collecting some real forensic facts. And the fact that they made the decision in such a short period of time to retaliate only meant to the fact that they weren't interested in the facts. And then the retaliation was lauded, you know, across the board, left and right media just, you know, falling over themselves to fall in love with, you know, this particular event was, you know, absolutely seemed preconditioned, and seems like it was pre-programmed to happen that way. It just seemed to fall into place, you know, better than anything, much better than they did the last time when they were trying to accuse Assad of a chemical bombing under the Obama administration. And what was more interesting is the fact that in Deir ez-Zor, just a few days later, the Americans bombed a chlorine facility that exploded as well and killed about 100 people in Deir ez-Zor. It didn't make the news at all in the United States. And obviously this week, unfortunately, this past week, we've had that horrible bombing that occurred in the where they were releasing some Shiite, the Sunni supposed rebels or moderate rebels were releasing some Shiite, and then the buses were blown up, and I think it was the number as high as 60 children were killed in those buses. So, and that made very little news in the United States as well. And there's nobody standing up showing pictures of those buses. And in the UN, Nikki Haley is most definitely a puppet for the Zionist cabal in the United States. And we don't see the same treatment. So it makes me really believe that it was an orchestrated event. They may even have known that it was going to happen ahead of time because they were very prepared to respond. And certainly they responded very quickly with, you know, about $100 million worth of Tomahawk missiles that were absolutely unnecessary. And the real icing on the cake is that they warned the Russians, so they were very deliberate about not killing Russians at the airfield.
I totally agree with that. I agree it had nothing to do with trying to distance Trump from the Russians. I just wanted to get your take on that. I agree with that as well. And I see Trump in exactly the terms you described him, as the George Bush type. He doesn't know very much about anything. And he'd have been called in the middle of the night and told, hey, Assad's bombing all these children. I mean, you described perfectly earlier on the sort of character he is. His daughter might cry about something and he might go to, you know, to his joint chiefs to say, we've got to do something. This is the way it is. And I think it probably happened like that. Look, he's killing these people again and we've got to do something. And Trump probably meekly said, well, OK, do whatever you think is necessary. I think that's the way it happened. How much pressure is Vladimir Putin under now?
Geez, I don't think he's under any pressure at all. You know, this guy obviously has, you know, brought his nation back from, you know, some extremely illegal sanctions, a tremendous amount of interventionism by the West and Ukraine and elsewhere. You know, I'm not a Russian. I'm not pro-Putin. I'm not even, I'm just a historian who realizes how the United Kingdom and Sweden has been going after the czars in Russia, you know, for hundreds of years. And the Americans, unfortunately, ideologically and not factually, have been dragged into this since the 1850s alongside these, first of all, the banking cartel, and now, unfortunately, the Zionist banking cartel. And then you see the tremendous resilience of a country, you know, that's about half the size of the United States, that's really rebounded from several devastating wars over the last 100 or so years. So this is my hat's off to the Russian people. I know it's probably not easy to survive, under any authoritarian government. But the fact is that, you know, this government has not only survived, but it's thrived, it's bounced back, and obviously it's one of the most resilient major powers in the history of modern times.
They're going to come under a lot of the reason why I asked you, do you think he's feeling the pressure? Because they're going to come under a lot of pressure, aren't they? I mean, we've heard the UK Foreign Secretary, talk about sanctions, and we see these extraordinary scenes at the United Nations with the Russian ambassador facing down the UK ambassador, Nikki Haley, nothing like it. Would increasing sanctions on Russia, how would that affect Russia, Scott, in your understanding? What damage would it do to Russia economically?
Well, I don't think Russia's in any situation going to be under any kind of pressure with sanctions. They've learned to deal with Western sanctions. Obviously, most of Europe is extremely anti these sanctions. Other than the Swedes and obviously the Poles. But when you look at the real powers in the region, certainly they're the ones that are most pro-sanction against Russia. But at the end of the day, a lot of these individuals realize, just ridiculous the Western foreign power has become. They don't support this initiative in Ukraine. Many of the European nations are extremely knowledgeable about how it was orchestrated and understand, that this this environment has been fabricated by the West, very much like what was done against Gaddafi, very much like what was done against, obviously, Assad. So I think people are getting wiser. If you look at the way that it's portrayed in Western media is saying that Russians are getting good at propaganda and they're spreading news to the alt-right. They would call me the alt-right or maybe the alt-left. I don't know. I'm down the center, if you ask me. But they would say they're spreading the news to the alt-right. And the alt-right is, getting the ear of individuals spreading fake Russian news. Well, that's not the case. For the first time in Western history, Western propaganda is actually being challenged. And in it being challenged, and this challenge, coming out, where the West is vilifying Russia, for its horrific, foreign policy in Ukraine. Russia did not actually handle Ukraine in a horrific way. They could have, but they did not. And the referendum in Crimea was absolutely done at a democratic level. So this is something that, the West did not understand. I think that Putin has been extremely reasonable and objective with dealing with the West, and very patient with dealing with the West and their sanctions. So I think that the people on the West are starting to get a little wiser, and I have hope for humanity in the West, and that then maybe they'll break out of their, indoctrinated mentality. But it's a very difficult thing. If you look at Orwell and Huxley and more recently Neil Postman, a lot of these guys write about how difficult it is to change the minds of individuals who grew up in societies that, most people in the United States just think that North Korea, Iran, and Russia, and China are horrible places because that's all they've been told their entire lives, and it's difficult for them to see it any other way.
It's what we were told growing up in schools. Yeah. You're absolutely 100% right, whether it was Waterford City in the Republic of Ireland or Sioux City, whether it was Kansas City, no matter where you were, that's what you were told. These were the bad guys, the axes of evil. I think that term came from Bush, didn't it, or on Bush's watch. Scott, so Putin is not going anywhere then, and he's not going to back down. Our listeners will say, that's all very well, but the lunatics will continue to, they will perpetuate these false flag events. They will put more and more pressure on the likes of Trump and the UK government to do something about it. They're not going to go away, Scott, I suppose, is the point that I'm trying to make. How do you see this unfolding over the next 6 to 8 months? Is it going to remain as it is now? A lot of, a lot of rhetoric, a lot of accusation and counter-accusation. Or are we likely to see more and more false flag type events to convince people that this guy has to go And if that means no-fly zones, or if that means, troops on the ground, even though US troops are there already, well, so be it. What's going to happen, in your opinion?
Well, unfortunately, I hate to say this, but I think if there's not a devastating enough, whether it's false flag or even a real incident, it's very difficult for a president to get public opinion. You look at Pearl Harbor or 9/11, unfortunately, the false flag, the Lusitania. These are events that were used even against Spain with the Maine. These are events that are used to gain public opinion, and the public opinion, basically gets individuals to rise up and actually enlist. You know, there's not a lot of people enlisting in the military right now, they comb the schools here with very good-looking Marine Corps women and Army women, and they basically try to recruit left and right of the students, across the board in our high schools here in the United States. So, and they're not, I'm not saying they're unsuccessful, but they're not as successful as they would be, given another, very tremendous false flag or even a real event. I'm not saying these events, I've certainly questioned a lot of the events of 9/11. I certainly question a lot of events of, obviously the Gulf of Tonkin, I know, was a false flag. The Liberty, the USS Liberty, was definitely a false flag that failed on them. And certainly this should be another false flag that happened with Assad that fails on them. What I would ask people to do is ask yourself a question, is who really benefits from this? And let's see the evidence first before we react to anything. And let's not be fooled again, because, to quote George Bush Jr., fool me once, fool me twice, fool me, I'm a fool.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. You know, I had Norman Baker on the program in the first hour, former senior minister in the coalition government 2010-2015, Liberal Democrat. And Norman... typically, now Norman is a good guy, and I'm not patronising him. He's a decent guy, Norman. He wrote a great book about the death of Dr. David Kelly, and he's asked a lot of very serious questions over the years as a politician. But he swallowed the anti-Assad propaganda hook, line and sinker, but not because he's a shill or because he's a plant. He just believed what he heard in the news, and I challenged him a bit. I said, look, there's no evidence that this guy started to kill his own people because of an uprising. There's certainly no evidence he bombed his own people using chemical weapons. And he acknowledged that there was no definitive evidence. And I thought, well, at least that's something. You know, even if he's a mainstream politician, it's something you're acknowledging, that we're making these decisions to oust people and to destroy whole countries based on no evidence. And there is no evidence. I want to ask you this, because we've talked a lot about Rothschild Zionism and banking and the takeover of politics and politicians by these people. You'll know this better than me, Scott, because you've been around a little bit longer than me. People listening to us tonight they're devastated by a feeling of not being able to do anything about it. They say, when we talk about programs like this, they say, Richie, Israel, the Israeli Zionist lobby, Lebensraum, playing a big part in the destabilization and the destruction of the Middle East for Zionist reasons. We had Cynthia McKinney on here once, one of the most astonishing interviews we've ever done. And she talked about how the PAC have basically taken over US politics. Our listeners they're ordinary people like me, ordinary men and women living in streets like the street I live on, and they think, what the hell can we do about this? We can do nothing. Because if we go to the ballot box, we are voting on men and women chosen by the Zionist cabal. It is a never-ending cycle of death, of violence, of mayhem, of murder. Give us some hope, they say. Now, that's a lot of pressure for me to put on you, and I'm not saying that for a laugh. What can we do about it, Scott, other than talk about it?
Well, obviously talking about it is the first step, so I think we're doing the right thing. Not a lot of people talked about this before. We barely understood it. And the fact is that now we do understand it. If you want to curtail an organization's success, obviously you have to hold it accountable very much like they're trying to hold the Russians accountable, supposedly, for their manipulation of American political environment. Certainly a more, I would say, guilty party would be AIPAC and obviously other political action committees that work on behalf of other, I would say, agendas that are not based upon American agendas. You know, these agendas, unfortunately, when it comes to Israel, are drilled into the heads of the religious communities in the United States through their relationships with their spiritual indoctrination. And that spiritual indoctrination was actually changed by the Scofield Reference Bible that came out of I guess it was printed in Oxford, and basically sold to the Americans and the evangelicals in the early 1900s. And we all bought into this sort of modified Bible that created this ideology of, you know, Zion and Zionism, yeah, yeah. And recreating Israel in what is in what was Palestine. So I think that the only way to attack that is you have to get into the spiritual minds of these individuals. If you look at the history of the United States, you know, if you don't go through the churches, you're not very successful. Martin Luther King was successful because of his ability to access the spiritual minds of the American people. I would say that would be the best case, is to be a spiritual sort of a guide and attend as much spiritual guidance as you can to move into a community that can work in unison and start to learn that, hey, maybe we were, you know, sold down the river, you know, in the early 1900s. You know, we do believe in this this Jesus Christ or this this particular religious underpinnings that we follow. But I believe that it was actually used against us 100 years ago. And now that I understand that, I think that what we need to do as a whole, as a community, on the left and the right, because, you know, the right is the religious right in the United States is an absolute tool for AIPAC. The religious left isn't as much as a tool, but it's certainly a tool for the left as well.
Ultimately, doing what you're suggesting there, ultimately the end goal would have to be, in my opinion, is convincing people to at least try, because I don't believe in telling people what to do. I don't believe that I should be dogmatic with people to dictate to people and say, well, this is the answer. But I would like people to try nonviolent civil disobedience and completely rejecting the system.
Well, the civil disobedience works, but I think working better, I mean, I'll finish my case for this.
Yeah.
There's some very powerful preachers in the United States. So I would reach out to the preachers and the judges in this country that still have reasonable and objective thought. And some of them are there, like Bill Hybel and Lee Strobel. Lee Strobel just did a movie that got some syndication in the United States. He put out a movie called A Case for Christ. He was a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist from the Chicago Tribune, whose wife became very Christian. He was an atheist, and he went out to write an article to prove that you know, Christ was a lie, and he couldn't do it. And he said, you know, there was just way too much evidence out there. And so that's basically the premise of the movie, is his transition on what he learned. And you know, when you talk to the objective individuals in the religious community, they could have a much more effective, I guess, result than any kind of these, you know. I've been to many, many, many of these nonviolent protests, and I got to tell you, you know, the IQ level is not very high, and the activity is very immature and not objective and reasonable a lot of the times.
Yeah, so, I mean, look, I understand that. I mean, my problem with religion is how that's been perverted.
And I'm saying it's been perverted, yeah. But I'm saying in its perversion, go in, and that's going to be your best tool. It's going to work a lot better than going out and dealing with what other environments that I've seen.
I get that.
It's been more effective throughout history as well.
I get that. But ultimately, we're still faced with, well, then we can change the system through engaging with the system in some way through exactly. politics.
Yeah.
And I just don't think we can. But it doesn't make me right. It's just how I feel about it. Do you know, when you were talking about that, what was flashing in front of my in my mind, Scott, was I saw Donald Trump's Easter message. And you want to talk about a total takeover of the United States by Zionism. If you'd have shown me the Trump Easter message, I would have thought it was an April Fool's gag. I couldn't believe what I was watching. He spends the first half of it talking about the Passover and about how the Jews are an amazing example of oppression and rising above it, and Israel is a perfect example. I couldn't believe what I was watching. And a part of me thought, look at how much in control this secret society of murderers and criminals are of the world, that they can get Trump to read a statement like that on national television, you know?
Trump is not only a tchotchke salesman, he's also a extremely experienced mobster. This guy is as close to the Red Mafia as we've been. You know, even Truman was put into office by the Mafia out of St. Louis. So this is not an old story in the United States, but this is one where this guy was in bed with Italian and Jewish and Russian mafia to the nth degree in the businesses that he was in. So it doesn't surprise me whatsoever that he's obviously kowtowing to the Red Mafia, and certainly it's very clear. Look at his son-in-law is 100% supportive of illegal settlements in Israel, and he's at the helm of Middle Eastern affairs for the White House. So his only qualifications is he's Trump's son-in-law and he's been involved in real estate as well. So this is not somebody who is qualified, but is somebody who is extremely well connected and extremely corrupt when it comes to the Zionist cabal and the Zionist mafia, because there's several forms of Zionism. There's Christian Zionism. There's obviously Red Mafia Zionism. There's right wing and left wing Zionism. It's a very large network. There's hundreds of millions, billions of dollars involved in the network. It goes throughout the banking, the commercial. It's just a tremendous reach into the petroleum industries, into the political infrastructures of many different countries. And I've put together tremendous amounts of research and networks into these individuals where I've actually written reports for the FSB, the KGB, and showed them who the people were that were working for the left and the right Zionists.
The names,
In the Russian news media.
Yeah, the actual names. I remember talking with you about this previously. That's right, the actual names of these individuals.
That's what you want to get down to. It has nothing to do with cultural or religious facts. It has to do with the actual individuals.
We've got about 90 seconds left. These are difficult times for the alternative media, which has always lived online. Programs like this, presented by people like me, who, and a lot of people in the independent media like me, have had experience of presenting on commercial and national radio and TV. But we know that in doing what we do, we live kind of online and we work for ourselves. And
you work hand to mouth too.
We work hand to mouth. This, right? There's an absolute assault now going on. There's a war on the independent media through this Google advertising thing. But not just that, but through the whole fake news agenda, Facebook talking about getting rid of posts it doesn't like. And others, what's your advice? Give some comfort to the creators, to the content creators that are having to deal with this and are wondering, well, how are we going to get over this obstacle? What do you say, Scott, in the last 90 seconds we have?
Well, I'd say the best thing for people to do is, obviously continue what you're doing, creating the content, learning as much as you can, spreading the word as through any social networks, network outlets. Obviously, when you've got Facebook and Google and those kind of individuals writing out, or those kind of companies writing algorithms that will curtail or limit our distribution, you know, that's one thing. But I would say, you know, look at the Al Jazeera is an example of how the West took an entire Arab community and indoctrinated it and basically made it a puppet to what they believed was real news coming out of Qatar. And Qatar financed that. So think about, you know, as moving forward, you know, there's organizations that claim to be doing this under Pierre Omidyar, who has started First Look, and obviously Craig Newmark is involved with ProPublica. He's putting money into that. But I see those as more soft-core left-wing Zionist outlets. But I think that what the and I've said this to a lot of people at PBS here in town, now that PBS looks like it might be unfunded, which, by the way, the people that work for PBS say, oh, yeah, there's definitely a cabal that runs the ideology and the news here at PBS as well. And they've given me lists of names of individuals who, you know, keep an eye on these people. So I've told them, I said, look, if you are actually unfunded, I said, what we need to do as a nation is we need to create our own style of Al Jazeera in the United States, but with external funding, very much like Russia, anybody from BRICS. You know, if you look at Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, these would be the countries we would have to turn to give us the hundreds of millions of dollars in order to compete, and compete much like RT does, and compete much like, you know, and make it so that, you know, individuals like yourself aren't living hand to mouth and aren't having to, you know, you would have a successful network wherein by you could have, you know, the kind of distribution. And then they'd be going after our distribution networks, you know, shutting down our satellites, very much like what they've done in England. They've shut down Press TV, for God's sakes.
That's
in
right.
England, because they were you know, losing that battle. And they had, you know, great guys like George Galloway, you know, broadcasting on Iranian television, actually informing the British people. So,
yeah.
You know, that's where we need to go back to. And that's what we need to do, is get our own satellite networks, get our own cable networks, and start getting in front of the individuals, because most people don't get their information off the internet. It's only about 10%. You know, we think this audience is growing. It's growing slowly, but kids that are young, they're not paying attention to news. When I was in my 20s, I didn't either, and I worked for the intelligence agency. So, you know, it's just you got to hit a stream whereby you become the water cool conversation, and unfortunately, that stream is like a tsunami with the current control that the mainstream media has upon our societies.
Scott, great to have you back in the program. Thanks for doing it. Folks, follow Scott on Twitter, @Scott_Rickard. Follow him there. You'll be back on again soon, no doubt, mate. Really appreciate your time and your analysis of what's going on. Thanks again, Scott.
Thank you, Richie.
Look after yourself. Terrific. Scott Rickard on the line to us there from his home in Florida. God, we're running over time. Very quick break, back in a minute.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markmajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Virtually every transaction that involves a child is valuable to somebody.
We intend to show everyone the real reason children are being removed at an alarming rate.
No, this is awful.
The baby's not been seen by the doctor or nothing.
They are psychopathic.
They have got the legal right to kill. kill children now, because that's what they do.
Traffic 2. Available now at premillionpictures.co.uk.
Right, well, that's about it for the programme. It's been great to be back. Thank you so much for tuning in. Really enjoyed your company. Two terrific guests. Norman Baker, former Home Office Minister. Thanks to him and to the excellent Scott Rickard there talking about the Zionist influence on recent events. Again, something sadly outside of davidicke.com, and David's been doing it for years, and one or two others you're not hearing so much about these days. That's it for the programme. It'll be online very soon by way of podcast, and the excellent Simon Stewart will have it on YouTube tomorrow, the interviews anyway. Hello, Simon. Thanks to Simon, to Aaron, and to you for listening. Until tomorrow at 7 p.m. BST, Wednesday's programme. It's bye from me, and thanks for tuning in. Great to be back, eh? Do stay in touch with our broadcast partners, davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2 and Alternate Current Radio. David is in Gothenburg, as I mentioned earlier on. For more details on all of that, go to thewordwidewakeup.com. I'll see you tomorrow. Bye for now.